Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes. Hello and welcome to another Trademark Belfast podcast. I'm joined again by comrade Stuart McGill and Sean Byers here. Today we're talking all things banking crises or banking crises that aren't crises and bailouts that aren't bailouts. The reason why we're going to talk about these things is because on Friday, the March the 10th, 2023, Silicon Valley Bank, you'll probably have read something about it, failed after a bank run went under. It made the headlines, but it's kind of been buried ever since, which is not surprising, of course. It's important to note, I think, though, that it's the second largest bank failure in US history that we're talking about here. So it's not a small thing. The biggest bank failure, of course, being Washington Mutual back in 2008. It's one of three US banking failures last month, the other being Silvergate Bank. I don't know too much about that. Maybe Stuart could tell us a bit about that. I think they were heavily invested in crypto and stuff. But the other one was Signature Bank, which closed 2 days later on March the 12th. And it was the third largest bank failure in US history. So these are serious events happening, but you wouldn't know that when you read the press. The addendum to that story is that that other bank that I referred to, the Signature Bank, was being investigated by the US Department of Justice for money laundering. But I'm assuming every bank would get investigated for that every now and again. But that wasn't the main cause of its collapse or their collapse. And the collapse, as far as I can kind of work out from a layman's perspective, is had more to do with government bonds and inflation and bond markets. So Sean, for our listeners, to give them a quick reminder, we did address this on previous podcasts. What is a government bond? Just very briefly, and why do banks buy them or invest in them?
Yeah, okay. So very quickly, a government bond is basically a debt package or instrument that's issued by a particular government to help meet public spending commitments and other obligations that they have. So they issue this debt. It's bought by banks and by pension funds and other investors, and they buy them because they're guaranteed periodic interest payments usually over a long period of time. And you have investors buying them because they're generally seen as a safe bet and as a guaranteed long-term income stream.
Yeah, basically governments always pay their debts. Isn't that the kind of thing we're always told? So if you hold government debt, you're secure that you're going to get some money off the government going forward. And we know that governments hold debts for hundreds of years, even. We've had this before, I think, in January 2015, the British government paid off debts or paid off bonds that they'd borrowed money to compensate slave owners from the abolition of slavery. So these bonds and these bond powers can continue for a very, very long time. So it's a secure source of income if you're looking for a risk-free investment. But something happened to the bond markets in the last couple of months, Stuart, and it was the bond markets, government bonds in particular, was it not, that brought SVB down. Can you explain to us in a couple of minutes, I know it's hard, what actually was the problem in SVB in particular, and then we'll go on and talk about some of the other banks that suffered as a cause of the collapse in the value of these assets.
Yeah, sure. First, let's talk about the thing that I spoke to you about a little while ago when I worked for the fascist pig financial sector. In a meeting, there was a guy, weird guy, and he said basically, risk is all in your head, and that some kind of mystical fucking trading strategy here, and that in his experience, the higher the returns, the lower the risk. Now, that wasn't our experience around the table. Everyone stepped back and said, what the fuck is this guy talking about? And the guy who was backing him up, basically his boss, said, remember, you can lose a lot of money from trading treasuries. And we all recognize what he meant by that one. Yeah, so this idea that they're risk-free is bullish. You can lose an awful lot of money from trading treasuries. What happens
just,
when...
Just a reminder for people, treasuries is another term for government bond.
I'm sorry, yeah. Bonds are commonly known as treasuries, and the UK government bonds known as gilt. Sorry. Now, SVB got a big influx of funds in 2021. Big investment boom in private technology companies. They wanted to maximize their returns, and in the era of ultra-low interest rates to placate their investors, it put $120 billion into highly rated government-backed securities. Now, this didn't get them much more additional dosh, but it kept the investors happy. They locked this away for more than a decade, which exposed it to losses of interest rates were rising. One of the problems SVB had, quite a sophisticated bunch of people deposited money with SVB, not regular punters like us. So other opportunities arise elsewhere to make money, to make better interest rates. They took all that money out, right? And so that caused SVB a bit of a problem anyway, because funds are very mobile these days, particularly with their educated investors. And that big portfolio started to look like it's going to be worth fuck all. Now, these losses on the portfolio don't get realized at the time. So you don't mark it to market. It stayed on the portfolio. But the thing is that if it looks like you need to sell the assets in order to make up for the losses, say, from the loss of your deposits, then you will take a hit and that will make you technically insolvent. That makes sense.
Yeah, just one quick question. I mean, when we knew that interest rates were going to go up and we knew that that would have an impact on debt, and particularly if you hold debt as an asset, as an income, form of income, could they not have predicted that? Could they not have seen that coming? Was it not really obvious that government bonds were going to take a hit?
Mate, the financial sector, like anybody else, will rationalize that which makes it money, and they will continue as if those conditions which allow it to make money will go on forever. I had a conversation with a guy in 1994 about the fact that we were all accumulating way too much debt. Each individual bit of debt, the banks I mean, looked good in itself, but in the total, this came to a massive systemic risk. The big boost in the banking sector prior to 2008, we made a lot of money basically because of mortgage-backed securities. Now, it's a complicated story, but mortgage-backed securities. All that was predicated on house prices in the States continually rising. They have never done that. US house prices continually go up and down. And there were some people, including I think Paul Mason may have said this as well, but others said, early part of the century, this cannot go on forever. We're building up all this debt on the back of US house prices not going down, which at some point they will. And so that's the way the financial sector behaves. You make money. You don't want to be the first one to say to your bosses, I'm coming out of this because we could lose money on this.
Yeah, it shows us again the irrational nature of the markets and the fact that the entire capitalist system, particularly its financial arm, is a massive Ponzi scheme. Sean, you wanted to come in to talk maybe a little bit about the response to the collapse of SVB and Signature and Silvergate and the other banks.
Yeah, that's just one of the things I find interesting when we're reading around it. The government is only supposed to insure deposits of up to 250,000, but of course there are exceptions built into the system now. And this exception was used to allow for all SVP deposits to be covered. And the reason for this is because SVP wasn't just a poopy wee regional bank. It's the 16th biggest bank in the American financial system. So the fear was that its collapse would lead to a bigger systemic crisis. And I think it was Adam Tooze or someone like that I was listening to, and they made the point that this situation, the response, highlights a whole double standard in not just in US policy, but in capitalist policy generally. If the point of increasing interest rates is to combat inflation, then you expect one of the consequences of this to be a failure of banks and other institutions. And according to the theory, what you do is you let these institutions go to the wall because that's the natural functioning of the market. But the Fed, the government, and so on stepped in. So whilst they're content with triggering job losses across the economy, they've stepped in to protect the financial system from the effects of their own policy, i.e. the interest rate hike.
There we go. Socialization of profit, privatization of risk. It's fundamental because we know what the classical definition of inflation is that there's too much money chasing too few goods. And so that if you want to reduce inflation, you reduce the money supply in the economy. And so it's literally like the government saying, working people have too much money. So we're going to make them have less because we're going to make it harder for them to borrow money to buy things, you know. The idea that working people have too much money is clearly a fucking ridiculous idea. And the consequences of raising interest rates is, of course, to discipline labour, to hammer the working class. And as we've seen from SVB and the next bank we're going to talk about, to preserve capital, preserve finance and save the people that took the risks that lead to the collapse. Stuart, you want to come in there briefly before I move on to our next bank?
Yeah, to be fair, contagion across the banking sector could be serious. I'm not in any way defending what these people have done in the banks, nor indeed the policymakers. The idea of actually increasing interest rates to take on an inflation which is caused largely by corporate profiteering is fucking nonsensical. But It's what they feel they have to do. They are, to a certain extent, the prisoner of some defunct economist, as I think Keynes said. But contagion can be very serious. So whenever it goes tits up, they think, if that goes bust, that one goes bust, and that is a major issue. We had that in 2008, and it could have happened here. The tragic thing is that banks are basically given this guarantee. So they know they can do what the fuck they want. And when we come to look at how we regulate banks in the future, we obviously should take them into public ownership. But the fact that they are given this public guarantee, we should charge them a hefty amount of money for that. And they should be kept to quite severe loan-to-value ratios, portfolio ratios, so they don't lend way too much. Because evidence shows that's what they do. You can go through the list of financial crises going back to the fucking 18th century. The banks will always do whatever it can to make them a whole lot of dosh, knowing that the government will fucking rescue them, which is a disgrace.
Yeah, and you mentioned the word contagion there, and the idea that the, you know, obviously states want to need to step in at some point, as opposed to try and intervene in what had the potential to be a banking crisis. I mean, in America, it's always being referred to as the 2023 banking crisis. So clearly it was a banking crisis. Of course, it's how it spreads across the globe. And next, and very quickly, and it was on, I think, 15th of March, it was like 5 days after the collapse of SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, was Credit Suisse. Now, when Credit Suisse is in trouble, you know that something's afoot, I suppose. I mean, Credit Suisse, we know, it's known for its secrecy, but it's also considered to be a globally systemically important bank. Now, I'm not saying SVB weren't and the other ones weren't, but Credit Suisse is like up there with the top financial institutions on the planet. Also known for hiding Nazi gold, and it was done for tax avoidance a couple of years ago and had to pay $2.6 billion fine. So there's those things to understand about Credit Suisse as well. But on the 15th of March then, so nearly about 3 weeks ago, its share price tumbled. It was close to collapse. And the Swiss National Bank and the Swiss government had to very quickly step in. And they had two choices there, didn't they? They had three choices. One was to kind of bail it out, I suppose, with public funds. Secondly, was to nationalize it completely. And they took a third option, which was to pretend it wasn't a bailout. And they organized the purchase of Credit Suisse by UBS, of course. And they went out of their way. Oh, this isn't a bailout. That's not a bailout. But they provided like 10 billion, I think, of credit. They provided 100 billion liquidity support. And I think I read somewhere there's something like one third of Swiss GDP had been kind of mobilized to prop up or to make sure that this deal went through, Stuart. So was it a similar story to SVB? Was it about government bonds again, or was there another story to
basically
the collapse of Credit Suisse?
Credit Suisse is interesting. There were good reasons why SVB went tits up. SVB had some major issues, which people actually highlighted about a year ago, like you say. With Credit Suisse, I was chatting to a hedge fund manager, student of mine, who said that during the whole process, recent process regarding CS Credit Suisse and regarding Deutsche Bank, sometimes I hate my profession. This makes me end up thinking like you, because he knows I'm a commie bastard. Credit Suisse was actually not in such terrible shape. There was no real clear and present danger of Credit Suisse going tits up. They had a credibility problem. Remember a few years ago, with the swaps, they lost about $5.5 billion on a single deal. And an awful lot of their investors, again, very, very sophisticated people, took the money out of them. I think that the Saudi guy, there was the Saudi International Bank or the Saudi National Bank, they said they wouldn't put any more money into them because it would force them to make a bid for the old.
I think the Qataris also called out and threatened as well not to give them any more capital.
Yeah, so they said we can't do any more to help this organization. That precipitated a little bit of a crisis, and so it was felt that something had to be done. I do believe that Credit Suisse, was seen as a bit of a basket case a few years ago, and at some point something would have to be done. That affected the way some of their depositors felt, and then later on their investors felt, and it had to be done. So it was a little bit like my old bank, NatWest. We offended the market to a certain extent. So whenever Royal Bank of Scotland made a bid for us, the market felt it was time for us to be punished and rationalized. Royal Bank of Scotland later on, of course, went to almost bring down the entire financial sector because they were a bunch of wankers.
Where is Fred the Shred, by the way? What happened to him? He was a great lad.
I think he's still somewhere up. Nobody else will give the fucker a job.
The point about Credit Suisse then is interesting because, I mean, it was also a badly run bank and they were taking too many risks in too many places. But, I mean, you mentioned before that, and since 2008, there are new regulations that have been brought in particularly for the largest ones, in terms of making sure they've got enough capital and their greater ability to absorb losses that they're gonna inevitably lose, of course, in speculative markets. But banks have also been stress tested as well to make sure that they can withstand losses. So has it been contained, if you like, that contagion or that potential contagion? Do you think they've done enough to contain the banking crisis? Because two questions in one, because you also mentioned, and I read a little bit about it last week, I mean, Deutsche Bank was also a little bit in trouble. When you hear that Deutsche Bank's in trouble, you're thinking that's quite serious, isn't it? So two questions there. Have they contained it? And is Deutsche Bank, should we keep our eye on Deutsche Bank and what happens there next?
At the moment it contained, the Deutsche Bank thing was fucking ridiculous. Bear in mind here, you see the thing in the FT a couple of days ago? The hedge funds made about $7 billion from shorting the banks, most of which I think was actually done on CSFB, not quite so big in Deutsche Bank. With Deutsche, again, they've had some problems, they had some issues, but they're a relatively safe, well-run bank. Things kicked off, and I think it was the price of the credit defaults, what's the CDSs? They went up by something like 30%, because people, I mean, it's a funny little market in which a few big trade can actually go ahead and affect it. So
other people know CDSs are insurance policies you take out on debt that you're trading.
That's right. Okay. The bonds, I think they dropped about 3%, all right, on the basis of the same level of risk. So obviously that market was a lot more rational than the CDS, and also it's a lot bigger and more liquid market. So Deutsche Bank, again, never really had that much of a problem. It was only there for a while. It offers an opportunity for some of the hedge funds to make an awful lot of dosh. It turned out that the market realized that this was a bank that was not going to go tits up. And certainly Deutsche Bank would never be allowed to go tits up because it's just too big. But, and the situation rectified itself. So are we saying...
It's accepted now, isn't it, really? I mean, since 2008 and before, you could argue, but it's accepted now that regardless of what banks do, regardless of whether they're a regional bank, regardless of whether they're an investment bank, regardless of whether or not, that states will step in to protect those banks and protect those financial houses above all else, and that people, working people, will be made to carry the can. It's just like that's how the system works now, isn't it?
Well, and that the government will go ahead and rescue them. So they are effectively there as some people in the states have described banks recently as wards of the government. They are there to help the government actually increase the money supply when they want, to help the government manage. All right, the money supply, when the money is downwards, if they feel it's appropriate, and the governments will always look after them. So,
this is all predicated on the fact that all of these financial institutions and states have to be preserved in order to extract surplus value from workers from this point to the end of time. If you're not a Marxist, you really need to fucking become one, because when you understand how that system works, when you understand that every time you open the FT or The Economist and you read what the government's doing regarding money supply, regarding banks, regarding regulations, all it's about is ensuring that exploitation continues apace. And the greater the debt burden, is this not a true thing? The greater the debt burden, whether it's corporate debt, whether it's state debt, the greater the debt burden, does that not guarantee that states have to therefore discipline workers, discipline labour, in order to make sure that that debt at some point is paid off or continues to be paid? And where does that profit come from? Well, that comes from exploiting workers.
I think that's a perfectly realistic analysis of where we are. I think in the... In a wider sense as well, we have to look at the problems we've had lately as an issue of what we do with the corporate surplus. And we've got addicted to low interest rates lately. And so there's been a huge surplus too from quantitative easing. And this has led to an economy which is based on asset price appreciation. Now, when it looks like those asset prices are about to go ahead and go tits up, that's whenever you get the issue. And we get back to Minsky as well here, who talked about stability breeds instability, because it's been a really good time over the last 20-odd years. If you had some cash, even with 2008, the government flooded the market with liquidity, and asset prices have appreciated massively. I mean, the house I live in is worth a ridiculous fucking amount of money right now. We bought it for 101, and they're now going for nearly $1 million, which is, for us, it's a paper gain, because we ain't going to move. The downside of it is that my kids cannot afford to buy a place anywhere. Yeah. So the big transfer of funds to people like me who don't actually fucking need the money. So there are all sorts of issues with this. And also, we talked about this in a bit on debt. You have a generation which is completely imprisoned by debt, and that makes people much less likely to be rebellious.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I said before, I don't know which American president said it. It might have been Woodrow Wilson or someone back in the 20s. He said an indebted worker is a disciplined worker. The angst to do then, getting workers into debt was the best way to make sure there would be no struggle, there would be no strikes. The idea that this may have been contained, of course, I mean, that the Credit Suisse thing in particular, they moved so quickly to make that deal. It happened like in a couple of days. I mean, a major World Bank was bought out by another World Bank in a couple of days. It shows you how scared they were. But also, it meant the contagion, maybe if there was the threat of contagion, didn't spread. But that doesn't mean the financial system, as you've just explained, isn't under serious strain. And many of the regulations they have introduced to make banks stronger and more able to withstand kind of potential threats doesn't apply to another opaque sector, which of course is the shadow banking system, which you rarely hear about and no one really talks about. And Sean, the shadow banking system it's expanded dramatically since 2008, precisely because of the new regulations that have been brought in. So it's another way that capital has innovated, great innovation from our capitalist masters. And it's grown dramatically, shadow banking, since 2008. And it remains far less regulated, as I said, than traditional banking. And also, Ireland, of course, plays a really important part in the shadow banking system. But tell us a little bit, Sean, about shadow banking and why it's a threat to the system, kind of the overall economy and to workers, and why workers should understand what the fuck shadow banking is.
Yeah, so just to begin with, basic sort of definition is shadow banking is, as you said, is a secretive, opaque, largely unregulated ecosystem of corporate loan sharks, insurance firms, investment funds, pension funds, hedge funds, and the big asset managers, BlackRock and so on, that sit outside of the traditional banking sector. And as you said, since the 2008 crash, we've seen a series of regulations introduced that have restricted the lending activities of traditional banks. And as traditional banks have stepped back from that more risky lending, shadow banks have stepped in and filled the gap. And shadow banking now accounts for half of the global financial sector, controlling something like $220 trillion in financial assets.
Does that include my credit union account? Yeah. I've got 800 quid in there at the moment.
They might have their hand in there somewhere. So in the last few years, the likes of the IMF have been warning about a potential crisis originating in the shadow banking sector. And there's a few things that make this sector particularly dangerous and risky. So shadow banking institutions themselves are highly indebted. They do house people's savings and the wealth of, you know, rich individuals, but increasingly become highly indebted. They're borrowing from the traditional banking sector. They're borrowing from the capital markets and from other shadow banks. They're borrowing from each other, right?
So that was just Tommy Tien, and who do we all owe this fucking money to? Venus, you know?
So that makes them really vulnerable to the interest rate increases that we've seen over the past year or so. Shadow banking institutions are deeply interconnected with one another and with the rest of the financial sector, which means trouble in one part of the system can have a major knock-on effect, major contagion elsewhere. And shadow banking institutions support and are themselves engaged in more risky speculative lending and investment than traditional banks. So in the era of low interest rates, what you see is a drive towards investment in higher risk sort of assets owned by private equity and hedge funds that promise higher returns for investors. But there's huge risks with that. And just as an example, different actors within the shadow banking system, and I know Sean will probably talk about this, have been plowing into the property market. So we're familiar with the rise of real estate in Ireland, in particular, real estate investment trusts, which are buying up 25% of all new housing. They're institutional landlords, they're buying up commercial property, housing, they're charging extortionate rents. And this is alongside the shadow banks that have been financing a lot of commercial real estate projects. So they're hugely exposed to the increase in interest rates, the coming fall in property values. There's some estimates that we see what they call a correction of 20% in property prices. And so that's a recipe for a financial crisis, not to mention the immense human suffering that that'll bring in terms of mortgage defaults, evictions, repossessions, and so on.
Yeah, it's interesting. So contagion won't come necessarily from the regulated banking system, but that's not to say that the shadow banking system might start the domino, one domino hitting another domino to collapse itself. And the shadow banking system can't be bailed out, I'm assuming, in the same way as the regulated banking system is. So it'd be interesting to see what happens there. And the idea that crisis could emerge from not within regulated banking, but from within the shadow banking system. Just as a small side note there, I don't know if it's still the fact, it was a couple of years ago, may have been even pre-COVID. I remember reading that these financial services centre in Dublin managed over 2 trillion euros through its shadow banking system in Dublin. And the Irish Central Bank, which isn't really a central bank because it doesn't control its own currency, just a little policy group of people fucking about there in Dublin, they had 2 people designated to oversee two trillion euros worth of shadow banking trade. So when this crisis does hit, if it does hit, we'll know why, because Noel's looking at it. Stuart, is there, I think you sent me something last week on the FT, an article there about that link between shadow banking and commercial property prices, and there are concerns about commercial real estate may well start to expose those kind of vulnerabilities in the financial system. Is there a serious risk in that?
Oh my God, yeah, I've been concerned about this for a long time, and more in the States, but certainly in the UK as well. And the thing to recognize here is it's not just the shadow banking system. In America, where many of these problems originate, I think if you have less than $250 billion of assets, then you don't actually get regulated the same way as the bigger banks. That was one of the issues with the SVB. Now, this is where the shadow banking and the small bank stories actually meet, because small banks in the States, this is, hold 70% of all commercial real estate loans. Now, that growth of that has tripled since 2021. So this is a big and increasing problem. Now, they ease some rules for these community banks. So the smaller financial institutions have also invested more in riskier assets owned by private equity and hedge funds, the sort of shadow banking guys that Sean was talking about. So have other institutions looking for better returns, including pension funds. So if you do have a pension fund, I do recommend take the fucking stuff out and stick it under the pillow now. This small bank funding to commercial real estate is going to have to tighten, along with the interest rate rises. This is, again, Sean talked about this before. This is serious downward pressure on commercial property values, which are now actually below pre-pandemic levels. This is going to curtail capital flows, derail investments, etc. Now, there was a recent note from T.S. Lombard. The level of real estate debt maturities in 2023 is going to be high. What this means is that asset managers may be forced to go to the investors for more capital. So basically, the loans become mature. You have to go back and borrow some more. This will mean some of them are going to have to sell property out of their portfolio to cover loans. That's the situation in the States. It is a very bad situation. I do not see how we can escape this without some major defaults. And this, again, is going to require some action by the government to bail out fuckers. And people like the big asset fund managers and so on, they're not going to be allowed to go tits up. So it's not just going to be the smaller banks that get taken out. But it's important to recognize here, this is the small banking sector, which is at fault as well. And this in the States is fucking huge. I'll send you some figures later on about
it. Does that mean that globally that property prices are going to take a 20% correction, Sean, as you suggested? Is that like, are we looking at everywhere that this is going to be a, not a collapse, but a serious, as they like to say, a correction in the market? Because that will affect Britain. It'll also affect Ireland, Sean, won't it?
Yeah, well, you know, like the Irish property market has exploded again since the last crisis. House prices and commercial property prices have exceeded 2007 levels, which were already really fucking high. So there's no way that this can't affect the Irish property market. And that's a recipe for a serious issue down the line.
And just before we finish on that idea about property, what about China and property and Chinese property markets? Is there risk in that system, Stuart, that could be contagion in terms of the rest of the global property market? Or will it come from the US if it happens with these shadow banks, small banks and commercial properties? Is there a chance that China could kind of feed into that?
China could well go tits up. Yeah, I read something today about the Chinese shadow banking system is huge. It's something like 60% of GDP. It's a big player. Chinese property values have gone excessively high. They're going to take a fall. Whether it affects all of us, I don't know. It depends to what extent the big European and British banks are involved in it. I suspect that's not going to be such an issue. But again, we don't know. I would doubt it. Some of our shadow banks will doubtless be involved in the Chinese market too. The bigger concern I have is the property values, like Sean talked about here, they will hitch up. And when you look at, say, San Francisco, almost 19% of space was unoccupied at the end of 2022, up from 5% 3 years earlier. There's been some really high-profile defaults already. There's a Canadian property giant, Brookfield. Last month, they actually stopped making payments on $734 million worth of loans, covering two prime LA office towers. A big landlord in New York, RXR, said it was negotiating with lenders to actually hand back the keys to two buildings in an acknowledgement they no longer made financial sense. We got a good old-fashioned property crash coming. In the 70s, we had this in London. We had the second bank crisis, and things nearly went tits up then. So now it's going to be a whole lot bigger.
In Ireland, Sean, it's interesting, particularly in the big cities, as you said, that housing crisis is it's very real. And as you said, it's had a massive impact and creating huge human suffering. But because of the absence of available housing for people to live in, the market's just going up and up and up in terms of the rental market, in terms of, you know, the profits being made in rich people and companies, if you like, and structural funds kind of flipping houses and buying up houses. But what would a new government have to do if it got in next September? What would a new government have to do in order? Because the only other option to the Irish housing market at the moment is it will collapse. I mean, that's like almost guaranteed at some point. It's going to collapse. So what would a new government have to do in order to head that off? Or could they?
Yeah, just to say that, you know, a collapse in housing or property market collapse in Ireland would spell a disaster for the financial system as well. Like, I think 80% or something, or 70-80% of the bank's assets are in property in Ireland. Like, so that's, you know, that's the kind of disaster that Stuart's been talking about. If you're talking about a socialist government in Ireland, what they need to do is put manners on those real estate investment trusts, those institutional landlords, if not ban them. At the minute, they're provided with huge tax breaks for investing in Ireland, which enables them just to swallow up properties like no one's business. So to put manners on them, if not just ban them from investing in Ireland entirely.
So we need to see governments disciplining capital, do we? Do you think there's any chance of that happening in the next short while?
I can't see how the current Irish government doing it. But to ban them, plus a massive, large-scale public housing program, requisition properties that are lying vacant, and put them to social use.
Go on, Stuart, you wanted to come in?
Very quickly, over here in Britain, 50% of Tory party funds come from the financial sector. A significant part of the remainder comes from the property sector as well. And this is one of the problems, the fundamental problems of capitalism. You put in place a wealthy money class which influences the politics. Since the early 70s, when Heath deregulated the banking sector here, the banks have become fundamentally property lenders. And I think it's probably the same here. About 80% of the book is property related in some way or the other. And of course, that's put house prices gone ridiculously fucking high as well. So this is where reformism fails. We need to destroy this sector and rebuild completely, and also do something more sensible with the economic surplus.
Thanks for that, Stuart. Thanks for that, Sean. We've come to the end of our time and our brief discussion on the banking crisis that's not a banking crisis, and the property crash that is not a property crash. So come here again for more good news. Listen to the Trademark Belfast podcast. Next time we meet, we're going to talk about a couple of subjects we didn't get to talk about. One is the new global tax rate of 15% from the OECD. And we also want to talk about the new IRA. About that, of course, I know it's an old joke. The Inflation Reduction Act introduced in the States this year, and the impact that's going to have on European industrial strategy and on state aid rules and on the European treaties, which will be a really interesting podcast. Thanks very much for your company today, lads. And I'll see you all soon. Don't forget to check out leftblock.ie. There's three other podcasts on this platform which are worth listening to. And so until next time, Sláinte go fóill.
That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers, and Sláinte go fóill.